From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Poor and White, poet Lloyd Van Brunt grew up in an Oklahoma orphanage. He says in his experience, people assume that if you're white, then you automatically had the opportunity to make something of yourself. And if you didn't, well, you're just white trash. Also today, we'll hear from Brian Benben, the star of the HBO sitcom Dream On. Dream On is now also being shown on Fox TV. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the Helen Merrill album Brownie. It's a tribute to the late trumpeter Clifford Brown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Japanese media reports 10 people have been found alive in the rubble of this week's earthquake. The death toll continues to rise, though. More than 4,400 people died in the massive earthquake this week. More than 650 people are still missing. Some 310,000 people are living in emergency shelters around Kobe. The central Japanese city was the worst affected by the shock. The Japanese Health and Welfare Ministry says the quake damaged so many underground pipes that water had to be shut off today to some 1 million homes. Hundreds of Japanese quake victims have taken shelter at Kobe City Hall. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead has visited the building and says it has been transformed into a relief center.
There are hundreds, possibly thousands, camped out on the different floors. But there is also a helpline on one floor, which is for anyone in Kobe or even outside who wants to call in and get information on what has happened with specific individuals. They can try to give whatever information they have, and also giving information on where to get relief supplies, when certain services like water, gas, etc. are likely to come back on, and just basically answering questions and soothing anxieties of people who are calling in.
NPR's Mary Kay Magstead. The White House is urging the House of Representatives to approve $40 billion in loan guarantees for Mexico. The loan package would help support the ailing peso. President Clinton wants Congress to approve the plan quickly in the interest of American jobs. Democratic Representative Sandra Levin was one of a group of lawmakers who met Mr. Clinton at the White House today. He agrees the United States should act quickly to support the Mexican government. He warns if Washington doesn't, the peso crisis could get a lot worse.
The crisis in Mexico today maybe is two or three on the economic Richter scale. I think if action isn't taken, it could be a seven or eight, and the ripples would be felt throughout the American economy.
Republicans say the loan package is threatened by partisan squabbling over other issues. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole supports the package, but says it's being held up in the Senate by a Democratic filibuster over the unfunded mandates legislation. NASA's administrator says at least 2,500 jobs will be cut there by the year 2000. Daniel Golden says the cuts are part of the Clinton administration's plans to shrink government. He says NASA is doing this because Americans want a smaller, cheaper government. The cuts are in supervisory positions at NASA headquarters and field centers, and Golden is warning that more layoffs can be expected. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 21 points to 3,860 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index has fallen more than 6 points to 762. This is NPR. The Federal Trade Commission says it will seek a court order blocking two medical device companies from merging. The FTC says the merger would create a near monopoly of the market for specialized catheters. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The FTC is seeking to block a proposed merger between Boston Scientific and Cardiovascular Imaging Systems of Sunnyvale, California. Both companies make and sell medical devices, including a new imaging technology to diagnose and treat cardiovascular disease. The FTC says the union of the companies would greatly reduce competition for the catheters and could increase prices and stifle innovation. Together, the companies currently control about 80% of the market. The co-chairman of Boston Scientific says they'll oppose the FTC efforts to block the merger. He says the move is pro-competitive and in the best interest of patient care because it will enable them to accelerate the development of new, improved, and lower-cost ultrasound imaging devices. The president of Cardiovascular Imaging Systems says he fears the FTC's action will harm, not promote, patient care. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A new survey on wages finds the highest salaries in the country are paid in San Jose, California. The study examined 200 cities, and San Jose ranked first for the second year in a row. New York City is second, Oakland and San Francisco are third and fourth. One study author says a typical high-level job that pays a wage of $50,000 a year in Houston or Pittsburgh would mean $61,000 a year for a San Jose worker. Pope John Paul is in Sri Lanka preaching harmony. He's faced growing resentment from Buddhists there who are angry over remarks about their religion in the pontiff's new book. John Paul today declared his highest regard for Buddhism, Sri Lanka's predominant faith. Sri Lanka's president, a Buddhist, welcomed the Pope as a messenger of peace, but Buddhist leaders are demanding an apology from the pontiff over his book. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview from last May with Lloyd Van Brunt. He's from the kind of background some people would call white trash. And if you use the expression white trash, that would prove his point, that prejudice against poor whites isn't seen as prejudice. He says, unlike African Americans and other racial minorities, poor whites have few defenders. Van Brunt wrote an essay about this, which was published last year in the New York Times Magazine. It was excerpted from his memoir in progress, I Fall in Love with Nancy Drew, about growing up in an orphanage in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Van Brunt is the author of several books of poetry. He serves on the Freedom to Write and Prison Writing Committees of PEN, the International Writers Organization. He's taught writing in schools and prisons. Lloyd Van Brunt says to be poor in a country that places a premium on wealth is in itself shameful. To be white and poor is unforgivable.
Well, I mean, in this country, it's unforgivable where so much emphasis is put on wealth that to be white and poor, you're not a member of a minority, so why should you be poor? Whereas the case is that poor whites have no more chance than poor blacks or poor browns to make it, and the whole this whole article was sort of engendered by the Tonya Harding case. I read in the newspapers, you know, they were calling her white trash, trailer trash. She had a low life lifestyle. And I thought that was kind of unfair. I thought that the same people who would be willing to call her white trash would in secret use racial epithets for other people. So, and I'd been called white trash myself in the orphanage in Oklahoma where mostly I grew up. They said that we were trash or we wouldn't be there. And half the kids had convict fathers, you know, prostitute mothers, and hopeless alcoholics and so forth and so on. So we had that, you know, sort of beaten into us day after day, year after year, that we were trash. And I got tired of hearing that word. And I just wondered, why is that more politically correct than to call someone a racial epithet? And I didn't think it was.
See, do you think a lot of people make the assumption that if you're white and poor, you're really a loser because there's no reason why you should be poor if you're white?
That's exactly. The loser-winner mentality in this country is also, you know, very pervasive. And you're either one or the other, a loser or a winner. And if you're white, you have no reason to be a loser. It's your own fault. Mm-hmm. It's like in the orphanage when they told us that, you know, it's your own fault you're in here. If anyone cared about you, you wouldn't be in here. So there must be something wrong with you.
You wrote that some of this became really apparent to you when you were teaching in a prison.
Yeah, right. I taught in a prison, and I had gone so far. It's a funny thing what the mind does with the oppressed and the oppressor. The oppressed tend to want to be liked, be like the oppressor. And so at that time, I was wearing $1,500 tailor-made suits and Turnbull and Asser shirts and ties, so that I thought, you know, no one would ever confuse me with that dirty little boy in the orphanage. I was trying to become just like the junior league ladies who used to come out to the home and escort us to movies once a month. you know, I was taking up their values.
Could you afford those clothes you were wearing?
No, of course not. No, I spent 60% of my income what it was, and you know, went way out on my credit cards and so forth. But I had this need. This was before I went into psychotherapy. I had this need to. I completely denied my background when I came to New York in the late 50s, early 60s. I got in with a bohemian group, most of them Ivy League educated, and I sort of copycatted their accents and their way of life.
You spent a lot of your childhood in a Tulsa orphanage. How did you end up there?
My mother, they said my mother was going to die. She had tuberculosis, and my stepfather didn't want to take care of us, so he parked us in the orphanage when I was 8 years old. And later my mother did die, and when I was about 12 years old, I was transferred to the state orphanage in Pryor. In fact, the first half of my book, I Fall in Love with Nancy Drew, is about mostly about the experiences in the orphanages.
Now, the stepfather who put you in the orphanage really fit the description of
poor
white racist.
Yeah, he had a racial epithet for everybody. I mean, you could be white. If you were Irish, you were a Mick or a Patty. If you were Polish, you were a Polak. If you were a Czechoslovakian, you were a Bohunk.
Well, listen, your mother's side of the family is part Indian, so what were you?
Oh, well, he used to have a term. I don't know whether I can say it on the air. But he used to get mad at us and call us prairie niggers. You know, that was a term for Indians that prejudiced whites used. And he said he's going to have himself cut after the birth of my sister so that no more of his children turned out that way.
How did you feel hearing your stepfather talk like that?
Oh, I hated him. I absolutely despised the man. I mean, I was lucky in that I did, that I didn't adopt any of those attitudes. I went as far in the opposite direction as I could. And my mother had, I remember, an argument. There's a long chapter in the first part of Nancy Drew, which was formerly entitled The Jews, in which they were having an argument. And my mother said, well, why hate a Jew just because he or she is a Jew? That's like hating a horse because it's a horse. And Charlie got all flustered and went back to the protocols of the elders of Zion or whatever that nasty piece of literature is. But he hated everybody. I mean, the only white people to him were the Scotch-Irish. In fact, he made fun of me not only because I was part Indian, but because I was Dutch. The Dutch were blockheads. They were krauts. They were what he fought in World War I. They were Huns. They were just low Huns.
Well, your mother found out that your stepfather had been sexually abusing your sister.
Right.
And so
right.
Your mother took your stepfather's rifle
and
basically held him at gunpoint for a
while.
Did you think she was going to shoot him?
I thought she was going to shoot him, because she was outraged. And she was sick, and she was shortly to die after that anyway. And then I think she changed her mind, and, he ended up worse than if she had shot him then anyway. And he was beat up in jail and later in prison.
What was it like for you watching that drama play out?
Children who grow up in households like that get used to a lot of drama, and that's something that affects you in your everyday life. I used to listen to them argue. I remember listening even to my real father before he left us when I was 2 years old. My mother and he would get into shouting arguments. And so the psychiatrist I went to said that I'd developed super acuity. I could hear better, I could see better, I could sense situations better, because you learn to do that as a child in order to protect yourself, in order to give yourself some kind of edge.
Well, I find it interesting that, on the one hand, you're very sensitive about this stereotype of white trash and
right.
that poor whites are racist, and on the other hand, your father really could have just totally personified that stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is that only about 10% of the people.
And you hated him.
And I hated
and everything he stood
I
for so much.
I despised him, So I just went off in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I came to the village, which I
Greenwich
think I call Greenwich Village.
Right. Right.
You know, I used to have an accent like this, you know, and I got off the bus and said, hey, where's Greenwich Village at, you know? But I hung out with people and I joined radical groups in the 60s. I got as far away from my stepfather's viewpoints as I could.
My guest is Lloyd Van Brunt. He has several books of poems and is completing a memoir about growing up poor in Oklahoma. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Lloyd Van Brunt. He's also writing a memoir called I Fall in Love with Nancy Drew, Tales of Childhood. When you were in the orphanage, you say that the pastime there was just, you know, gnawing at each other's self-esteem.
Yeah, well, yeah. As I said in one of the tales in the first part, normal procedure was to take a new boy, an seven, eight-year-old boy, and hound him across the playground. With this sort of wretched rhyme, you know, your mother's dead, your father's a red. I can't say it over the air what else we said, but we treated each other since our own self-esteem had been taken away. We were very cruel to each other.
So what were you most vulnerable in the kind of verbal attacks you were subjected to?
Oh, we played what black people used to call the dozens. About your relatives, about your mother, your father, you know, your mother's a whore, your father's a wino. And we could see pretty soon, after a year or so of that, you developed a kind of a skein of hatred and contempt yourself, and nobody could hurt you. But before that, I wrote, sort of, welcome to our world, kid, welcome to our world. It was not only the matron. We had this one particular matron, a boys' matron. She used to whip us in the shower with switches and razor strops. And then she would pull the offender out, say, hey, Del Mar, get out of there. And she'd give him a couple of dozen strokes and then make him kneel down and put his hand on the Bible and ask forgiveness of the Lord. And I found that I always seemed to have a kind of objective part of my mind. I found that funny. I found it absolutely ludicrous. I thought, this woman is sick. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with her. And there was.
Now, the memoir that you're writing is called I Fall in Love with Nancy Drew. And in the memoir, you say your first love was Nancy Drew.
Oh, sure.
There were a lot of Nancy Drew books in the orphanage library.
Right, right. A big library. I think it was Mrs. Phillips, an oil man's widow, who had endowed it. And she had all these books specially bound, sky blue covers. You had to take a page knife and cut the pages. And not only Nancy Drew, but the Hardy Boys, Rider Haggard, Mark Twain, and the William Farley Black Beauty series. There must have been, 3,000 books in that library, and I think during 5 years I read them all. So I got a head start. And I really like Nancy Drew because even though she was 16 years old, she continually outsmarted grown-ups.
Mm-hmm. You know how you said you believe that the oppressed often
right.
try to imitate the oppressor, and you
Good.
Know that
yeah.
you did?
Yeah.
Well, you had people who were beating you all the time at the
right.
orphanage.
Right.
Did you want to get out and eventually beat people yourself?
Sure.
Did you
yeah.
ever get
mm-hmm.
into that?
Mm-hmm. No, I never got into it that much. I went around with this rage, though, against people. I had a chip on my shoulder for years, decades, until I got into psychotherapy. I was hostile. I didn't trust people. At one time, I made up a theory. When I was about 14 years old and I was out of the orphanage, my real father had come back and we lived together for about 3 months until a couple of incidents of, I've got a block against the word. we had sex together. what's it called?
Incest.
Incest, right. I know I have a blog against it. I still haven't worked that completely out. But, and then then of course, after that, I went back into the orphanage rather than to continue to live with him. I never forgave him for that. I blamed him for everything. And that only added to the rage, you know. Well, I guess I used to get into fist fights when I was younger, you know, hanging out at the White Horse Tavern in the village. And I would have a few drinks and become very abusive. And so that's what that legacy it leaves you with. You don't have any power as a child, and you have all these arbitrary forces pushing you this way and that way. I remember the matron used to slap me in the face, and that particularly irritated me. It was not only painful, but it was demeaning as well.
You had one matron who, after whipping you, would have sex with you.
Yeah, right.
That must have really screwed up your mind.
She was the same one, yeah. When I turned about 12 years old, yeah. That was, yeah, I didn't know. I sort of, the same way I did with my father, I just sort of disassociated myself from the whole experience. I said, this is not happening to me. This is happening to somebody else.
How old were you when you got out of the orphanage for good?
I kept going back, and let's see, when was I about 15? I ran off to California to an aunt and uncles who agreed to take me in for a while. And then when I got tired of them, I went to high school. I took a year off, and I just hitchhiked and rode freight trains back and forth across the country because I'd read Jack London, and I thought that's what writers were supposed to do, have adventures. And I ended up, I nearly froze to death, nearly starved to death. But I did see the country, actually, in the early 50s before the superhighways. And that was very interesting to walk through a small southern town at dusk or dawn and just, you know, be alone by yourself with your own thoughts. I mean, you're full, at that age, you're full of illusions. You're full of hope. You think anything is possible. So you really don't pay that much attention. The reality of it might have been fairly sordid. I mean, I slept in Salvation Armies and missions and so forth and so on. There was certainly nothing romantic in that. But I thought at the time that, you know, I was on a great adventure. And one thing that helped me in that I was already 6 feet two and I could pass for 18 or 19. So anyway, I got to see the country that way, and I'm glad I did.
Well, I mean, you were hopping freights and stuff and traveling around, seeing the country, at probably about the time that, say, Kerouac was on the road and
yeah.
And so on. So it was actually probably you didn't even realize this at the time, but there was something about it that was in the air.
I didn't realize it at all. I had no connection with the. By the time I came to New York, that scene was just about over. The beat scene. I remember dressing up as a beatnik and writing sort of neo beatnik poetry, or trying to. It was a great way to pick up girls, or women, or try to, and that was one of my continuing obsessions then. I used to go down to the White Horse Tavern, have a few beers with Delmore Schwartz and some other people. So I thought the first 5 years in the village were highly romantic. At that time, there was still the tradition of the bohemian artist.
You've taught in prison. You've taught in schools a school in the South Bronx.
Right. I've taught, for 20 years now, off and on. Mm-hmm. I started out in Pennsylvania, Maryland, South Carolina, upstate New York, and for the last 7 years in New York City.
Remember you were talking about the way kids in the orphanage used to try to tear apart each other's self-esteem?
Right.
You see a lot of that in prison and in the schools that you've taught in?
Sure, yeah. The guys in prison, they form into gangs. You have to belong to a gang. You can't possibly go around being independent. And most of them carry what they call shanks, which can be any kind of a razor blade or something, a piece of steel with an edge to it. There's a great deal of stabbings, slashings, and rapes that go on in prison. And also, when I'm working in schools, I work with a lot of troubled children, and I think I have an advantage because I know what's bothering them. I know that it's lack of self-esteem. That's why they act rowdy and cuss, and they'll always test you on the first or second day. But if they feel that you really care about them, and the thing with these kinds of children, I think with children in general, is that they can't be praised enough. So I find something in their writing to praise. I'll give them an idea, not necessarily a poem, but a creative writing exercise. And then I'll go around and say, hey, that's good. I really like that. And that may be the first time that kid has heard a compliment in years. So, you know, he gets a different kind of look in his eye, and he becomes interested. Some of the worst troublemakers turn out to be the most original writers.
Did you ever teach middle class kids?
Yeah, I taught them in Pennsylvania. The first time I taught them, I had difficulty relating to them. Some of them were middle class, some of them were upper middle class. I had the son of the mayor of this small town. And I had trouble connecting with these kids. When they said something smart to me, you know, I would get mad. I would throw them out of the class. I would say, you know, you go stand outside or go to the principal's office. You know, you're grounded. Because I was determined to be just as hostile to them as they were to me. I could easily have defused the situation, just gone back and the way I do now to kids in slum areas and say, hey, you're hurting my feelings. You know, could you think about stopping? Could you think about giving this program a chance? But no, I got just as belligerent as they did.
Why did you think that these students were somehow less deserving of your sympathy?
Pure hatred. Just carry over hatred. I'll tell you an episode from my childhood in the orphanage. We used to go out and pick the crops of the rich contributors to the home. We got to keep half their melons and string beans and so forth. And one day after lunch, they fed us out of the kitchen door at the back room with the servants. And I saw all these kids over by a great swimming pool. And they were all cavorting around, having, you know, splashing and having iced lemonade and so forth and so on. And there I was, dusty, hot, itchy. And I looked at them and I said, you know, hey, I'm a pretty bright kid. What's the difference between me and them? And out of that, I remembered things like that. Out of that grows a kind of hatred of other people for no other reason than it's kind of reverse prejudice.
Having grown up with an abusive stepfather, a mother who died when you were 8, and then you were in an orphanage where, you know, you were beaten a lot.
Right.
Did all that make you want to have a family of your own or not want to have
No,
a family
it
of
made
own?
Me sort of afraid to have a family uh-huh. of my own. I don't have any children. I've never been married, though I've lived with one. Well, that sounds kind of casual. Actually, it isn't. I've lived with one woman or another for the past 30 years. I think Nina and I will eventually get married. But no, it makes you kind of afraid to have children of your own because I think you're afraid that you're going to pass on the same kind of abuse and mental cruelty that was inflicted upon you.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes you... I never wanted... I consider... I call my poems... my children, and now I call Nancy Drew my child, whatever yeah. I happen to be working
your
on
memoir.
At
yeah.
the moment. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Lloyd Van Brunt, his latest collection of poems is published by The Smith in Brooklyn, New York. He's completing a memoir called I Fall in Love with Nancy Drew. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. HBO's hit comedy series Dream On is now also shown on broadcast TV. Sunday nights, Fox is running episodes from Dream On's first season, which began in 1990. Coming up on this archive edition, we feature an interview recorded last year with the star of Dream On, Brian Benben. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording by singer Helen Merrill, which pays tribute to the late trumpeter Clifford Brown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The comedy series Dream On has been a hit on HBO. Now viewers without cable can see rebroadcasts on Fox TV. Sunday evenings, Fox is running episodes from the first season of Dream On, which began in 1990. On this archive edition of our show, we have an interview from last fall with the star of Dream On, Brian Benben. He plays Martin Tupper, a book editor in New York who's the divorced father of a teenage son. Although Benben insists he isn't as neurotic as his character Martin Tupper, Benben says he relates to nearly everything about Tupper.
What I liked most about the character and about the show that we do is that everybody's pretty flawed, and everybody's capable of lying and dissembling with the best of them, but it doesn't mean they're not nice and likable people, you know. They're just flawed, you know.
Your character of Martin Tupper is always getting into predicaments where he has to, you know, he's an editor at a not very good publishing company, so he has to take on these books that he knows are ridiculous, he knows they're awful, but he has to shepherd them through. And his best friend does one of these morning talk shows where he has to do ridiculous cooking with washed-up celebrity type segments. And they both know that they're trapped in these ridiculous professional situations. And I'm wondering if you've ever felt trapped in a situation like that yourself in your own career, being in a play or in a movie that you felt like, God, this is really awful, and I'll have to do my best.
Absolutely. It's frightening even to think about. But, you know, I've definitely had those experiences. And it's interesting because I've talked to other people, and it always seems to be the same. First, you know, you have this dawning sort of slow realization that this is a real turkey you're involved with. Then you spend a lot of time trying to save the whole project.
Right.
And then by the time you're done, you're just desperately trying to save yourself, you know. Nothing else is of any concern.
Well, how do you try to save yourself in a situation like that?
Well, you just try to protect your performance and you know, not... trying not to look as much a moron as you feel that you probably are, you know. And there's a variety of ways of doing that. It depends on the instance, I suppose. The interesting thing about this character in the television series is that I think that he, you know, he's always trying to turn some kind of failure into, yes, that was actually a victory. You know what I mean? I think he's very forward moving in that respect.
Now, on Dream On, your ex-wife, Judith, is now remarried to someone named Dr. Richard Stone, and he's the most perfect human being in America. He works with Mother Teresa when he isn't being a guest on Nightline or isn't on the set of a made-for-TV movie about his illustrious life. Is there someone who's the equivalent of that in your life, someone who's, like, very perfect in a situation similar to a situation you were once in, and he's always showing you up, and it drives you mad?
I don't think so, primarily because I have no male friends.
It's one way to avoid this problem.
That's right. All my friends are women. So I think I've successfully avoided that particular problem.
Now, how does your self-image compare to Martin's on the show? His self-image usually isn't all that good. As an actor, I think you probably can't afford to have too bad of a self-image because you always have to pass yourself off as kind of confident.
Well, I guess that's the big conflict with actors is that, you know, their egos are huge, but they're, you know, I don't know if their self-worth is very large. And I'd be hard put to even, you know, even begin to sort of psychoanalyze myself in that respect. But what was the question?
Self-image.
Is this major avoidance or what?
One night when I was just flipping around the channels with my remote control, I saw you in what I thought was probably a tough guy role. And I have no idea what I was watching. And it was like in the 3 minutes before I went to sleep. So I had to like turn off the TV.
Probably the best way to watch some of the movies. I've been,
actually. what were my options? What might it have been?
Well, I don't know. What was I wearing? Was I wearing a fez and a caftan?
No.
That must have been one of my...
No.
I don't know. What was I wearing? A suit? Did I have real short hair?
You had short hair. Was not I... real short hair.
Oh.
I mean, it wasn't like, wow, look at that really short hair.
I don't know. I did a movie with Dolph Lundgren called I Come in Peace. gosh, I don't know. It might have been that. I don't know. But I don't know what you possibly could have been watching. A heavy. I was a heavy.
Yeah. You were. You were the heavy. I looked up I Come in Peace in Leonard Maltin's movie guide because I haven't had the pleasure of seeing it.
And it wasn't in there, right?
No, of course it's in there. But you co-star with Dolph Lundgren, who was one of the boxers in Rocky IV, right?
Right, right.
And
I gave him some pointers, actually, after that.
Really? So this is a cop movie where you're partners and the bad guy is an alien from outer space who's harvesting people for their endorphins.
Pretty embarrassing, isn't it?
Well, so...
Let me just tell you,
yes.
it was directed by Craig Baxley, an ex-stuntman and a second unit director. He's a very talented guy who directed the picture very well, but, you know, the script, it left a little bit to be desired in terms of just what it was about. And at one point I said to Craig, I don't know, I don't think this really makes sense. We were talking about some scene, and he sort of leafed through all the pages and said, you know, none of the rest of it does either. You know,
right.
what are you going on about? But, yeah, I worked with Dolph, and, you know, I'm like 5'6", and Dolph is like 6'7", so I was really like a hand puppet next to him, and I had to wear lifts in my shoes so I could get in the same shot. But it was fun. We ran through a lot of naphthalene explosions. You know? How often do you get to do that?
Did it hurt?
No, it didn't. I mean, you know, I kept looking at Dolph and thinking, God, I wonder how dangerous this is. But he had this sort of implacable expression on his face that I realized later he always has. So I don't know what the actual danger quotient was, you know.
My guest is Brian Benben, the star of the sitcom Dream On. We're after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Brian Benben. You grew up in the Hudson Valley in New York. Is this growing up in the country?
Yeah, I grew up actually in Apple Orchards. Well, I had a house, but it was in Apple Orchards. You know, I didn't live in a lean-to or anything. But yeah, I grew up in a farming community mostly.
Now, your father was a produce buyer for a supermarket, for a small store?
Yeah, for A&P, the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was... He was a big man in lettuce and onions and celery and apples and he I think every kind of fruit or produce he has bought at some point. He's retired now.
Did you get free vegetables at home?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, and when my mother would go away, he was a wonderful cook. Cheese and onions, and he'd eat out of the skillet so he didn't have to dirty another plate. He had it all worked out.
So, did you ever have to work in the supermarket?
No, but I worked in a lot of packing plants. I worked in apple packing plants and onion packing plants and processing potatoes and all that stuff.
Were you always dreaming of a way to get out?
Absolutely, I absolutely hated it. Actually, I was just up there visiting, and I drove by a little steel yard that I used to work in. I accelerated. I wanted to get by it as quickly as possible.
Did you think acting would be your ticket out?
Oh, I know. Not really. I you know, always wanted to act, and I of course, never thought that I'd, you know, make a living at it practically, I suppose. But I didn't really train to do anything else, so I must have had some faith.
Did you act in school?
No, I didn't.
That's surprising.
Yeah, no, I started acting when I was about 17, and actually I sort of fell into a nice situation. It was up near in High Falls, New York, and these people who had been, I think, chased out of New York City had a theater up there, and we were doing these very... sort of avant-garde plays, you know, by Slavomir Mrozek and people like that. And then when I moved to New York, I started working in sort of a radical gay theater where we were doing equally strange things, you know. So it was just a... And I, of course, thought that everyone's youth as an actor was like that. And I'd watch these things or hear people talk about the beginning of their career, and I just thought, that's ridiculous. Nobody goes to college and studies acting and does musicals. They all work at avant-garde theaters, you know, where everyone wears leather, you know.
How did you end up in radical gay theater? I know you're married now.
Yeah.
I mean, to a woman.
Well, I wasn't radical or gay, and I'm still not, but I was to a woman.
People marry other people of their own sex. It's just not a City Hall ceremony.
Yeah, no, it was just it was a great place to work. You didn't have to be gay to work there. Most of us weren't, you know. But it was a man named Doric Wilson, who was a that's Doric Wilson,
mm-hmm.
who was a
not Dork, right? Okay,
right, was a playwright, sort of a radical gay playwright, and an offshoot of our theater was the Glines, I believe, you know, and so which is here in New York. I don't know if they still exist, but he was, you know, he dedicated this theater doing plays by with either a gay theme or by gay playwrights, which was, you know, really all-encompassing, you know. So we did all kinds of stuff, and it was a wonderful place to work. It really was.
But it was okay to be a straight actor in there? I mean, it's like some gay theater groups, some, you know, groups like that, you have to be, like, part of the circle to be part of the group.
Not at all. That was one of the wonderful things about it. You know, it was in the 70s, and there's a lot of sort of radical stuff still happening. But mm-hmm. but it was a very nice atmosphere, you know, and it was sort of, it didn't break down along any kind of lines at all. There were gay people who worked there. Most of the actors were straight, as I remember. And it was a wonderful, very protected place to work. Just a little different, you know. I mean, it's not every bathroom, you know, that the public has to use there, you know, has a penis collage in it, you know, in like ours did. So, you know, when your parents come down and go see a show, it gives them something to think about as they're weaving out, you know.
Well, what did they think of it?
Well, they didn't say much, you know. I think they think, oh, we're so proud, you know.
Were they worried, among other things, that, not only is it in these productions we don't understand, but now everybody's going to think he's gay?
I don't know. I didn't talk to him much about it, you know. They seemed to take it in stride pretty much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was a basement theater. I lived in that theater actually for a little while when I had no place else to go. So, you know, I'd stay there. We'd do the play. Everybody would go home, and I'd stay. You know,
talk about a life in the theater.
Yeah, on the living room set. You know, it was. You know, it was actually kind of relaxing. You know.
Now, on HBO, the character you play is Jewish, and I know in the Gangster Chronicles, which I'll confess I haven't seen, you played Meyer Lansky,
right?
The famous Jewish member,
right,
of the underworld. And I wonder if you've often been cast as Jewish, if you're Jewish yourself. And...
No, I'm not. I'm on Dream On, his mother's Jewish, so that would make him Jewish. He's half Jewish.
Right.
I don't know. I've played a lot of Jewish guys and a couple of Jewish girls, now that I think of it. And, you know, it's that radical gay theater. You really get to stretch as an actor and as an actress, I might add. I'm my people were Polish Catholics, actually. And though I'm not a Catholic, I've accepted Buddha as my personal savior. Oh, that gave you a little start, didn't it? I can tell. You know, you're thinking, oh, no, here we go. That's the end of this interview. The Buddha in me loves the Buddha in you. You never hear anybody say that, do you? That's the problem with America. I've had absolutely no religious training or background whatsoever, and don't want any.
Uh-huh.
I read all the big books, you know, the good books, and that's enough. Yeah, they're all Polish Catholics, and my mother's from German extraction from down south.
The name Brian Benben, your last name Benben, is I've never heard the name before.
Yeah, well, you know, I certainly didn't change it to that. You know what I mean? You know, originally it was John Benben, but I wanted to throw the Brian in there to sort of more cross-cultural kind of reference. You know what I mean? the tip of the Martin to you. Yeah, it's a very strange name. Although, you know, it's interesting because I was just visiting my family, and they someone had had the errant, you know, impulse to send off and get the Benben book to see where all the Benbens were. And actually, there are quite a few of them in this country, and some in Belgium and France as well. And I'm sure we're all related. I think we've all actually procreated from raiding warthog dens or something long ago.
Did you have problems as a kid growing up with a last name that rhymed?
Does it rhyme?
Well, it repeats itself. Maybe
it
that's the more precise
itself.
Way of putting it.
Yeah, it's onomatopoeic. I don't know. What does that mean? Well, no, I mean, they're the requisite sort of nicknames. Benny, I know that's hard to believe, you know, but people were very creative where I grew up.
So what's in your near future? Any other movies or projects coming up?
I don't know. I'm sort of waiting to hear about whether or not we have another season of Dream On. It'll be our sixth season, our last one, and I think I could probably get through another short season. I think the it gets a little tougher every season because now, like one of our writers told me, he said we're starting to do stories like Martin dates a girl with big ears, you know. But Martin dates a girl with hairy knuckles, you know, stuff like that. So I think that we're sort of approaching, coming to an impasse there, you know.
If Dream On ends in the near future, is there a particular type of role you'd like to try?
Oh, you know, I take every, you know, my own personal experience is that nothing leads to anything. I know that sounds depressing, but that's just been my particular experience.
It's a nice philosophy of life.
Right? Yes, isn't it? I embrace it wholeheartedly, too. You know, why bother? I take each job as it comes. You know, I guess I'd like to do something a little different now, but I don't care. As long as I work with good people and worthy projects that are interesting and a little different, that's all I care about. I know that's not a lot to ask, but that's what I'm asking for. What I'll receive, who knows?
Well, good luck. I thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Brian Benben is the star of Dream On, which can be seen Wednesday evenings on HBO. You can see rebroadcasts from the first season Sunday evenings on Fox TV. Dream On begins its sixth season on HBO this summer. Our interview with Brian Benben was recorded last fall. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have about the earthquake in Kobe?
Well, we'll have the latest on relief efforts there. Also, a bit of the outlook for the Japanese economy and what impact the quake will have on it. A Japanese editor talks a bit about the city of Kobe. And in other matters, we conclude our series on sex with a story about sex and race today. And we'll also be hearing about the uncertain outlook for loan guarantees for Mexico on Capitol Hill. And what kind of a week it's been in Congress from our own Elizabeth Arnold and from Major Garrett of the Washington Times.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1954, singer Helen Merrill recorded an album with an orchestra featuring jazz trumpeter Clifford Brown. Brown died in a car crash 2 years later when he was 25. Last year, Merrill recorded a tribute to Brown featuring four guest trumpeters, Roy Hargrove, Tom Harrell, Wallace Roney, and Lou Soloff. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's pretty good.
The things he played are with us now, and they'll endure should time allow. Oh yes, I remember Clifford. I always seem to hear
Helen Merrill with Kenny Barron on piano and Roy Hargrove on trumpet. Although Clifford Brown died in 1956, some musicians who knew him, like Max Roach, Sonny Rollins, and Helen Merrill, still speak of Brown with deep affection and a lingering sense of loss. By all accounts, he was a terrific guy as well as a great musician. So it makes sense that Merrill would record a tribute to him even at this late date. Her album, Brownie, is mostly made up of songs the trumpeter recorded during his short career in the early 50s.
The fire will dwindle into glowing ashes, for flames and love live such a little while. I won't forget, but I won't be lonely. Thank you.
Francis Reed is the bass player, and the trumpeter there is Tom Harrell. The current craze in jazz recording for bringing in guest stars to play on a few tracks is getting out of hand. At worst, it's like those old Hollywood Bible epics where they'd hire John Wayne to play a centurion and have him deliver one line during the crucifixion scene so the studio could put his name on the posters. The guest trumpeters on Helen Merrill's tribute album all owe something to Clifford Brown, and their individual contributions are good. But someone decided that on a few tunes, all four trumpeters should play transcriptions of Brown's solos in unison. Now, the trumpet is a tough instrument, technically, and four of them trying to play together in tune may sound pretty sour. The end result can be pure kitsch. Not that kitsch isn't entertaining. Overall, what makes this tribute to Clifford Brown work isn't that parade of horn players, but Helen Merrill. Her deadpan vocal delivery gives a melancholy air to this recital that fits the concept. The feeling Merrill conveys makes up for the occasional flaws. It's not perfect, but it's a worthy tribute.
I'll be looking at the moon. But I'll be singing. I'll be singing.
Given Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice, he reviewed Helen Merrill's album Brownie, homage to Clifford Brown, on the Verve label. Here's the late Clifford Brown. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shirock, with Ellen Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our program was directed today by Alan Tu and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Gang Wars in Cyberspace. We talk with journalists Michelle Slatala and Joshua Quittner about two rival gangs of computer hackers, the Legion of Doom and Masters of Deception. And we talk with one former gang member who went to prison for hacking. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.